Today is Thursday, March 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up.
While Brexit negotiations have consumed European governments, many European citizens have been less interested in the drawn-out process of Britain leaving the European Union.
That's Lisa Bryant reporting on the latest Brexit developments. Also ahead, New Zealand's Prime Minister says all military-style semi-automatic and automatic assault rifles will be banned. And a new TB regimen will help save the lives of people with HIV who contract TB. It's all on today's International Edition. For close to 3 years, Europeans have been watching the chaotic Brexit process unfold with a mix of indifference, exasperation, and to a lesser extent, alarm. While every twist and turn in the tortured negotiations has grabbed British headlines, most other European media have covered the process only sporadically, concentrating on concerns closer to home. A Euronews poll released in January found nearly one-third of French and Italians thought Brexit had already happened. Lisa Bryant from Paris has more.
The line for the Paris to London Eurostar high-speed train stretches halfway across the Gare du Nord, one of Europe's busiest hubs. The reason? An ongoing strike by custom agents aimed to warn passengers and the French government of what might happen with Brexit. But some passengers are worried about more than long waits.
As a Dane, I think it's such a sad catastrophe seeing a country sort of self-destruct like this, and it seems so unnecessary. So very sad on every level.
Danish architect Max Broby has businesses in both Paris and London. He's talking about Britain's exit from the European Union. He calls himself a strong EU supporter.
Obviously, there are lots of reforms that should take place with the EU, very critical reforms that need to take place, but surely you want to be around the table and not, in times like these, start burning your bridges and stuff.
Across Europe, citizens' sentiments about Brexit are mixed. Some, like Broby, think it's a big mistake. Others are cheering Britain on. But many have not been paying much attention to the process.
People just have other priorities.
Larissa Brunner is an analyst at the European Policy Center in Brussels.
I think it's seen as quite an isolated issue, sort of the British shooting themselves in the foot with limited consequences for the rest of Europe, where something like, for example, the migration crisis affects people's everyday life.
In fact, a recent poll showed nearly one-third of French and Italians thought Brexit had already taken place. Citizens from the 27 other member states, excluding Britain, also have mixed feelings about the European Union. A new Pew Research Center survey finds that while most give the bloc high marks for promoting peace, democracy, and prosperity, they find it inefficient, intrusive, and lacking understanding about their everyday life. Still, the Brexit process is changing some European mindsets. Analysts cite a modest rise in support for the EU, and some populist parties, like France's National Rally, are toning down their rhetoric and no longer talking about leaving the EU. Manuel Lafont-Trapnoy heads the Paris office for the European Council on Foreign Relations.
I think a lot of Europeans now see what is happening and how difficult it is to achieve Brexit under acceptable circumstances from the British perspective, and therefore have a lot more cautious.
At the Gare du Nord, French passenger Diane Hamadash, waiting in the Eurostar line, says she understands why Britain wants to leave the European Union. Like Britain, the French like to keep their identity, Hamadash says, and she believes the European Union has increased France's debts. But she ultimately believes the EU is a good thing. In another part of the station, Dutchman Jerome Wiesing is about to board a train for Amsterdam. Unlike the Eurostar, there are no lines here. France and the Netherlands are part of the passport-free Schengen zone. Wiesing believes Brexit is a bad idea. It costs to be part of the EU, he says, but citizens have a lot of advantages. With Brexit, the Netherlands will have to find other trading partners besides Britain. It's too bad, he says, but that's the way things are. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, nearly 1 week after 50 Muslim worshippers in Christchurch, New Zealand were gunned down, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says all military-style semi-automatic and automatic assault rifles will be banned. The ban, which Prime Minister Ardern announced today in Wellington, includes high-capacity magazines which can hold multiple rounds of ammunition and accessories that can convert ordinary rifles into fast-acting assault rifles. Ardern also announced a buyback program to encourage owners of such weapons to surrender them to authorities. Well, Dutch prosecutors said today they will charge the suspect in this week's deadly tram shooting in the city of Utrecht with multiple murder charges with terrorist intent. Prosecutors believe Turkish-born Gökmen Tanis acted alone on Monday when he allegedly killed three people and seriously wounded three others. Prosecutors and police said in a statement they are still investigating whether the 37-year-old suspect acted out of a single terrorist motive or whether from personal problems in combination with radicalized ideas. Among the top stories in the world, Venezuelan opposition leader and self-declared interim president Juan Guaido says intelligence agents have detained his chief of staff. At least 60 people are dead after an overloaded ferry sank in the Tigris River near Mosul in Iraq. And China says a high-ranking U.S. delegation will travel to Beijing next week to resume negotiations aimed at resolving the ongoing trade war between the world's two leading economies. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Results of a new study show that a shorter regimen to prevent TB can be safely co-administered with the first-line drug to treat HIV in many countries with high numbers of tuberculosis patients. People living with HIV who are 20 to 30 times more likely to move from latent infection to active TB are now dying from TB in large numbers. TB causes close to one-third of all HIV deaths every year, around 300,000. The results of the study will ease the fear of potential drug interactions, and it paves the way for a scale-up of what's called the 3-HP regimen in 12 high-burden TB countries across three continents. The study was carried out in South Africa by the Aurum Institute and the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine from the United States. Gavin Churchyard is CEO of the Aurum Institute and co-principal investigator on the study. He spoke with me about the exciting findings.
The Dolphin study was evaluated the safety and the drug-drug interactions of giving the new short-course TB preventive therapy regimen of high-dose azithromycin and rifampicin, which are the two antibiotics taken weekly for 12 weeks, with dolutegravir, which is currently being rolled out as first-line treatment for HIV globally. And the reason we conducted this study was that 2 years ago at CROI, the National Institutes of Health had presented a study where they evaluated the two regimens, so dolutegravir with 3-HP, but in healthy volunteers. And that study got stopped after only four people were enrolled because two of them had developed a severe hypersensitivity reaction. And so we were concerned around the safety and whether the drug-drug interactions meant that we may need to double the dose of dolutegravir or not.
What types of people were involved in this study?
We conducted our study among HIV-infected individuals, and they were switched from their favorite regimens on to a dolutegravir-based regimen for 2 months. And then we introduced the weekly treatment of the high-dose azithromycin and rifampicin. And we then followed them very carefully for safety, as well as for measuring the drug levels of the various drugs that were being taken. The study was conducted at a place called Tembisa in South Africa, one of the townships in South Africa. And we followed these participants while they were on treatment, and we checked for safety and their blood levels very carefully. And what we demonstrated was that giving the CHP to people on the dolutegravir-based antiretroviral therapy who are HIV infected is safe and does not require a doubling of the dose of the dolutegravir. So what this means is for programs that individuals that are in dire need of preventive therapy due to their very high risk of developing active TB disease, and notably those people that are living with HIV, can now safely take the CHP, the short course 3HP regimen, along with the new antiretroviral therapy, the dolutegravir. So this is news that everyone needs to be waiting for, and now that we have it, we can consider moving forward with scaling up the short course TB preventive therapy to prevent TB in this high-risk population.
When will this be available?
So the short course regimen is currently available. The one antibody called rifapentine is manufactured by Sanofi, but there are generic companies that are currently in the process of developing the rifapentine as well. And then also the isoniazid is available from multiple sources. So we are working to reduce the cost of the rifapentine so that it will be accessible to people living with HIV, including in poor countries.
So then can you tell us more about how important this is to people who are living with HIV? Because many of them do die from TB.
Correct. We have moved from a time 20 years ago where people were dying of HIV to now where people living with HIV are still dying, but of TB. And at the UN high-level meeting on tuberculosis that was held last year in September, the world committed to treating 30 million people for TB infection with either the existing or these new regimens. So there is a large global commitment to providing access to these treatments.
That was Gavin Churchyard, CEO of the Arum Institute and co-principal investigator on the study. He spoke with me from Seattle, Washington. Well, in Ohio yesterday, U.S. President Donald Trump spotlighted the U.S. manufacturing industry, a key piece of his 2020 re-election strategy that is being undercut by the closure of a large GM auto plant in the state. Trump's focus on manufacturing is lauded by his base, but is it actually helpful to the industry? White House correspondent Patty Wittes-Kazwara reports.
President Donald Trump is bringing the focus back to what he considers his success, the revival of the American manufacturing industry.
You better love me. I kept this place open. That I can tell you. They said, we're closing it. And I said, no, we're not. And now you're doing record business.
In politically vital Ohio, Trump visited a military factory that produces tanks and military vehicles, highlighting his effort to enlarge the U.S. defense budget and boost manufacturing in the heartland. But Trump was unable to bring back jobs elsewhere in the state with the closing of General Motors' Lordstown plant. He's blaming the auto company.
What's going on with General Motors? Get that plant open or sell it to somebody and they'll open it. Everybody wants it.
Trump also blamed the plant closing on the union representing the GM workers. Claude Barfield is from the American Enterprise Institute.
The kinds of things he's doing today, like trying to browbeat or beat up on General Motors or Ford or Chrysler or something like that, don't help the economy. They are helped by larger U.S. economic policies in relation to tax, in relation to the budget, in relation to regulatory policy.
Trump's focus on manufacturing may win support from his working class base, but analysts are skeptical it makes financial sense in a globalized economy. The tariffs on steel to help the industry, for example, could actually backfire. David Dollar is from the Brookings Institution.
Steel is extremely capital intensive. Firms are producing more and making more profit, but they haven't hired anybody. On the other hand, steel is used in a lot of production. Auto production, construction of housing. So we're losing jobs. We're losing blue-collar jobs because of the steel tariffs. Now they're talking about auto tariffs. You know, all of these things tend to reduce the number of jobs, not increase the number of jobs.
Trump won Ohio by 8 percentage points in 2016. It will again be a key battleground state in 2020. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Well, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, warns political divisions in Venezuela are worsening on an already critical human rights and the humanitarian situation in the country. In a report presented to the UN Human Rights Council, she urged the dissenting factions to resolve their political differences. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the council in Geneva.
Human rights chief Michelle Bachelet says escalating human rights violations are leading to a further deterioration of the economic and social dynamics. Bachelet says it also is serving to destabilize conditions in the region. She notes more than 3 million people have fled to neighboring countries in search of food, health care, work, and protection. Bachelet says peaceful protests and dissent are criminalized. She reports her office has documented numerous rights violations and abuses, including killings by security forces and pro-government armed groups. She says during nationwide anti-government protests earlier this year, people were threatened and intimidated, arbitrarily arrested, and subjected to torture and ill treatment in detention. Bachelet says her office continues to investigate reports of hundreds of possible extrajudicial executions by the security forces known as FAES.
It appears that some of these killings have followed a similar pattern. They take place during illegal house raids carried out by the FAES, which subsequently report the death as resulting from an armed confrontation, although witnesses report the victims were unarmed. Most of the victims live in poor neighborhoods and participated in anti-government protests. And I'm particularly concerned about reports that indicate that this type of operation is used as a form of reprisal and intimidation.
Bachelet says the volatile political situation is exacerbating the humanitarian crisis. She says people are going hungry and that lack of health care is increasing maternal and infant mortality. She says more than 1 million children are not going to school. This is because their parents cannot feed them breakfast and school feeding programs have stopped. The UN rights chief says she fears the recent sanctions imposed by the United States on financial transfers related to the sale of Venezuelan oil may worsen the economic crisis. Venezuela's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Jorge Valero, accuses the international media of distorting his country's human rights record. He says Venezuela is a free and democratic country where peaceful protests are allowed. Valero blames part of the opposition for instigating the violence, which he says is whipped up by foreign funding. Valero also accuses the United States of pillaging Venezuela's economic resources and denying his country the possibility of acquiring the food and medicine it needs for its people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. This is VOA's International Edition.
It's the weekend. You deserve something special, and I've got just the thing. A relaxing, exciting, refreshing platter of Pan-African music. That's right, sweeten up your weekend with me, Heather Maxwell, on Music Time in Africa. You'll hear exclusive interviews with Ghanaian Afro-reggae artist Rocky Dawuni and singer-songwriter Ben Soul.
One of their most active and vibrant artists on the scene. Mm-hmm. My collaboration with him was in a song called Wicked Sound.
My Song of the Week features a great song by Voodoo Game, making big waves in Togo right now. And there's so much more awesome music, you don't want to miss it.
Stop wasting good time.
So sweeten up with me, Music Time in Africa, this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Oh yeah!
As rising nationalism and the crisis surrounding Britain's exit from the EU intensify divisions on the continent, a new exhibit in Paris looks instead at a powerful unifier. Music arriving with post-war colonial migrations helped turn two of Europe's most important hubs, London and Paris, into multicultural melting pots. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris for VOA.
Rhythm and blues, reggae, rye, and rock and roll, Europe and other Western regions got world music long before the term was invented. Even the Beatles were much more than a British brand, borrowing from Asia and sometimes West Africa. How it blended into popular culture today is a central theme of a new exhibit that examines three decades of post-war migration to Paris and London through music. France and Britain needed extra manpower to fuel their fast-growing economies. They got it from former colonies that had just achieved independence. For immigrants in Paris, it was a tough beginning.
The migrants lived in special area, what we called foyer, for instance. There were a lot of strikes during the 70s in foyer de travailleurs. They were working in factory during the day, sharing the life of everybody. But at the end of the day, they had vanished in their foyer.
Stéphane Malfait is curator of the exhibit that opened this week at the Paris Museum of Immigration History. He says the immigrants were initially sidelined from France's mainstream musical scene as well. Things changed in the 1970s.
The music became very strong to protest, to exist in the public space as an instrument of revolt and protest.
Across the English Channel, migrants in London also faced racism, but Martin Evans, another exhibit curator, said they were introducing the city to ska and reggae from Jamaica, music from East Africa, and calypso from Trinidad and Tobago.
They could become profoundly London, and in a sense, I think that's a measure of how much this migration has transformed London by the end of the 1980s.
The parents of British musician and filmmaker Don Letts emigrated to Britain from Jamaica as part of the so-called Windrush generation. He said they wanted to integrate by denying their roots. It didn't work.
Ironically, it was their culture, particularly their music, that would capture the imagination of the white working class kids. And it was our culture that would actually help us to integrate with society.
Letts says the cultural exchange went both ways.
I was inspired by a lot of the things that I grew up with. I grew up digging the Stones, the Beatles, Bowie, Roxy music, and all the rest of it.
Meanwhile, Paris, by the 1980s, had become a hub for African music. Singers like Papa Wemba, Khaled, Youssou N'Dour, and Salif Keita. Music producer Martin Messonnier was among their earliest fans and producer of some of the biggest artists.
Out of pleasure, I was discovering all these new musics, and I thought it was a gold mine because it was fascinating. It was all these incredible bands.
The musical fusion has left a powerful imprint on today's artists, and it has changed not only how we think about music, but about each other. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Over to the African continent, international aid workers are scrambling to deliver desperately needed relief supplies and rescue scores of survivors who have been stranded since Cyclone Idai struck three southern African nations last week. Helicopters are conducting food drops over villages that were destroyed and cut off from the outside world after the cyclone hit Mozambique's port city of Beira, then swept inland to neighboring Zimbabwe and Malawi. Aid officials say an untold number of survivors are clinging to treetops or are trapped on rooftops of houses that remain submerged by floodwaters. The combined death toll in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi has risen to more than 300 people. A number of that is expected to climb as the floodwaters recede and search crews finally enter the damaged areas. President Filipe Nyusi of Mozambique has said he expects the death toll to exceed 1,000 in his nation alone. Mozambique began 3 days of official mourning yesterday. Ways International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Xiaogun Chang. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.